The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we are joined once again. Hello there, Peter.
Hi, Soraya.
And, so in studio once again, and we're going to be doing something kind of different tonight. We have, what's Ryan's last name?
Sprague,
okay. I didn't want to say it wrong. And halfway through, he's going to be joining us to talk about his play on Rendlesham. And, you've known Peter a little while, or yeah, I guess you've known Peter all your life. You've known Ryan a little while now?
A couple of years, yes, indeed.
All right, so that will be probably about 11:30 because he's working now. And so we're gonna talk a little bit about UFOs again, following up our last show, which was back in September. And we'll go from there. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully this will work out all right.
Great.
And for anyone who missed the first show, your background is UFOs in general, but you've especially with Rendlesham.
Well, it may be the case that I'm best known for, because it resulted in a book that was well received in the UFO research community on Great Britain's best known and best documented UFO incident.
Right.
But one of many subjects I've tackled over the years.
All right, okay. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, I had done a midweek podcast with Paul Kimball. And anyone is welcome to check that out on wheredidtheroadgo.com. And Paul's definitely more in the skeptical category.
He is.
And one of the things we talked about was the use of hypnosis in the alien abduction scenario. What's your opinion on this?
It depends on the practitioner. Hypnosis is simply a tool. One of the myths about hypnosis as a tool in exploring the abduction phenomena is that people approach practitioners, researchers who are knowledgeable in regressive hypnosis with some free-floating anxiety. And under hypnosis, their heads are filled with specious nonsense that they've been taken by other intelligences. Nothing could be further from the truth, as I observed it over the years that I was Bud Hopkins' assistant. And
really?
For about 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in fact, Bud and I, and for those in your audience who are not familiar with his name, he's certainly one of the most important people in the history of UFO studies. And to use a characterization, probably the father of serious scientific abduction studies. And he trained rigorously to do that work. Also, for the first 7 years he did it, he worked under the guidance of a very distinguished psychiatrist, Aphrodite Clamar. And Dr. Clamar was a pioneer in using abduction and exploring trauma. But the reality that I observed was almost all of the people that approached Bud, and I was with him, we became friends in the mid-1970s, 5 years before he published his first book on the subject, as artists that had a very serious interest in this subject. And in the hundreds of cases I was privy to look over his shoulder on or work with him on, almost everybody that approached him did so with at least partial memories of experiences that they had had, and in many cases, literally complete memories, and wanted to undergo regressive hypnosis to either confirm their memories, fill out details, or learn more of what had in fact happened to them. So, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but if you've had the opportunity to work alongside somebody like this, and I was a witness to more regressive hypnotic sessions that Bud did than I can remember over several decades. And the only time Bud would lead someone would be in the opposite direction. You know, you were wearing a red shirt that day, right? No, I was wearing a blue shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a responsible way to use that tool. But I think if you've never worked with somebody that has done it or carefully read through responsible transcripts with people like Dr. Mack or Dave Jacobs, Dr. Jacobs, or the great Yvonne Smith, who is a psychotherapist on the West Coast who does this work with primarily abductees, then, you know, you might well think that.
Now, the thing with that podcast, it started off with Emma Woods and Dr. Jacobs, and Emma did produce audio recordings of her sessions that didn't paint David Jacobs in too good of a light. Any comments on that?
Not much. I wasn't involved or privy to them.
Right.
And I just don't know how to comment on them responsibly as a result. I think Emma is a very disturbed person who, at a certain point, set about to really methodically hurt Dr. Jacobs' reputation as a historian, as a highly regarded associate professor of history at Temple University, to a point of real viciousness. I think she was able to present herself in a credible light, but we don't, one thing for sure is her name is not Emma Jacobs, and her identity has never fully been established. And I can't help but wonder about certain people's intentions. Also, she was the one who literally begged David to take her case on, even though they would never meet. She, I think, lives in New Zealand.
Yeah, or Australia, something like that.
Yeah, correct. So for me, there's a number of incomplete pieces here to comment on.
Okay, all right. I was always impressed with Whitley Strieber's books in the fact that, like, in Communion, when he first met Bud, Bud Hopkins, we're talking about, he was totally resistant to the very idea, at least so he says, that this could have been happening to him.
I'll tell you some things I could have never told, would have never said in public years ago because the confidentiality agreement involved. Whitley approached Bud in 1987 when Bud and I were working very closely together. And as his assistant, I had to be privy to a certain amount of confidential information, which remained that way. And so I was aware that this very well-known writer had approached him. And I can say now, and Whitley's made it public, you know, years ago, that he was literally suicidal. He was terribly upset about what was happening to him and people he cared about. And it was Bud who helped him find a therapist to help him understand what had happened. Ironically, it was Bud who found the artist who did that iconic cover. And I should segue here for any of your listeners who know the cover of that famous first book, Communion. It's a very stylized version of some non-human being. But in fact, it's a confabulation of actual descriptions and the artist's imagination. Right. I don't think there's ever been one report of an alien or another intelligence, so to say, that looks like that. And after the book came out and became a smash bestseller, a few months before Bud Hopkins' Intruders came out and became an international bestseller, Bud got dozens and then hundreds of reports, and Whitley thousands, from readers who had had experiences and said it was the cover of your book that made me pick it up and start to read it. But the one I saw, it didn't have a nose, the chin was different, it looked like this. Everybody corrected the image. Anyway, as part of his therapeutic and being a writer, and it got me to read some of his earlier work because I hadn't read it, And I thought, gee, you know, he is a good kind of gothic fiction writer and, you know, sort of a demi Stephen King. And I loved Wolfen, the movie with mm-hmm. Albert Finney. I thought mm-hmm. that was a terrific film, and another yeah. film had been made. And I guess about a month or two before the book came out, I was at home and got a call, cold call. Is this Peter Robbins? Yeah. Who is this? This is Whitley Strieber. Mm. Okay. He said, Bud Hopkins told me that I could call you. I asked him if he knew someone who would be completely honest with me about the manuscript that I've done and give me good feedback.
Wow.
And who was knowledgeable enough on the subject and who was a writer and understood writing. And I wonder if you would do me the favor of reading the manuscript for this book that I've written. And I thought to myself, yeah, I'll do that. And I think it was just a few days later, Soraya, I showed up. It was probably on a weekend because I was working a day job. I showed up on his doorstep in the West Village and about 9 a.m. at his request. And he and his wife and son couldn't have been more gracious. They put me in a guest room with a big honking manuscript.
And this was for communion?
Yes, okay. Yeah. This would have been probably the spring or early in 87. And I read that entire manuscript in one day, making notes as I went. And they came in at intervals and, you know, with coffee and sandwiches and lunch and dinner. And I finished early that evening and we sat down. And he said, what do you think? And I told him. I thought it was going to be a very important book, and did he realize what he might be taking on and making himself a public figure in this? And he certainly has done so with a lot of grace, I think. Yeah. I have not followed much of his writing since, but I think his most important contribution to the work is in that book and in keeping a hand in the field and being there for people that have had similar experiences, for sure.
Yeah, I like his later work as well. I think he's definitely expanded on it and been very open-minded as he goes into this. He's never been somebody who says, this is what it is, and that's that, and that's the final word. He's always been very open. He's changed his view of it so many times, and that seems to have actually earned him some heat from the UFO community.
I think you're right. People are funny, and we like to associate other people with a set view of things that we can trust and come back to. This work can be pretty mercurial, though. I know when I first became interested in the 70s, my view was they're aliens from outer space, and the government knows stuff, and power to the people, and tell us everything you got. And over the decades since, I've come to feel we don't know definitively and empirically where these other intelligences come from. They're probably quite an assortment of them, although that is just deductive reasoning and educated guessing. I don't think that their motivations are all the same, nor their relationships with the human race. I think some may genuinely be concerned about our evolution future and what we're doing to our planet.
Right.
Where others have very different thoughts in mind and not necessarily with our best interests. Are they from other planets, universes, solar systems, dimensions? Yes. and as far as disclosure goes, I think we have a right to know more about what the truth is here. And there's no question about the fact in my mind that our government, to lump it all together, because it's...
Yeah, there's so many pieces of government.
Yeah, and within the intelligence community and special ops and all. But that we do know things that we're not sharing and we're lying about it. However, unlike, say, Dr. Stephen Greer, who feels, you know, everything should come out now, I really question the wisdom of that. You and I... And a relatively small percentage of our brothers and sisters here on planet Earth probably are ready for the truth. Most people are not.
True.
they are poorly prepared, and just because, you know, we want to know these things, is that enough justification to dump all this on the populace at large? And how do you engineer releasing information in a way that it's going to produce a minimum of panic, a maximum of education, a solidarity between people rather than people just freaking out? I don't know. And once you start to release the information, you know, okay, you know, lights in the night sky, some of them are intelligent craft, you know, et cetera. And by the way, there are these things called hybrids, which are part us and part them, and some of them look so much like us that they probably pass. Well, that's just great to know that that weird guy in the apartment across the way is probably from Neptune, and I'm going to kill his ass if he looks at me funny. And I'm only half joking.
Well, it almost seems to me like the mainstream government probably doesn't know anything. You know, and if anyone does know anything, it's probably the deep secret groups that you're never going to get any information out of.
That's absolutely correct, I'm convinced. And as far as any given president goes, following Truman, who probably knew as much as any of the people around him, Eisenhower probably knew an awful lot. He was well-liked by the intelligence community. He was former commanding general of the Army in European Theater of War. But following that, those two administrations, I think the president has known what the forces that be want the president to know.
Right, right.
And my best sense is, you know, in those first days of briefing after briefing after briefing, some contingent comes in or some individual and says, Mr. President, it's my solemn responsibility to inform you that these so-called UFOs, some of them do represent advanced technology under the control of intelligences who come and go with impunity from who the heck knows where. And that we, you know, we've recovered some, we know something about it, but our advice to you is just pray to God that it doesn't break in your administration and that you get to pass it on to the next president. And if you're curious, that's nice, but don't push too hard.
Yeah. And the thing is, I wonder if it's also something that we can't actually understand fully. So maybe that's where some of the different versions of it come in. Why nothing quite looks the same, because we're putting our face on it.
That's a great observation. I think it was in the 70s that the great anthropologist Margaret Mead was asked if she had an opinion on this. And Mead was to anthropology back then what Carl Sagan was to astronomy in the 90s with his, you know, big television show on PBS, Cosmos. She was the head of anthropology at the Museum of Natural History. And as best as I remember her statement, it was to the effect of, I have no idea how they think,
right,
or how they reason, so it's very difficult for me to offer an opinion. However, the best I can do is say, in putting myself in their place, if I'm on an expedition and we pushed our way into some remote area of the Amazon Delta and some unexplored part of South America, and we part the foliage, and there in the valley is, you know, an anthropologist's dream, a pre-Stone Age tribe that's never been touched, no planes ever gone over, no contact with civilization. Our passion would be to observe until gold or oil is discovered on their land, then all bets are off. And for me, another favorite model comes from science fiction, and the great Gene Roddenberry and his construct of the Prime Directive.
Right.
And that is based on very good anthropological models. Namely, if you interface with a culture that is decidedly not as advanced as you, do not show them everything you're capable of, they will have a cultural meltdown. And of course, it happened time and again in the age of exploration.
Hmm. All right. Well, Ryan is ready to come on with us. So we're going to take a quick break and hook him into everything. And We're actually going to hear a song from a band called One Eyed Doll that we play on the Last Exit for the Lost a lot, called UFO. Not sure it really has anything to do with UFOs, but it's short and it's called UFO. So when we come back, we'll have Ryan on with us. And we're talking with Peter Robbins in studio. And Ryan, what's his last name?
Sprague.
Sprague. I don't want to screw it up. All right. We'll be back in a couple minutes on Where Did the Road Go?
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And that was One Eyed Doll here on Where'd the Road Go in a song called UFO. And I believe I have to hit this button here. And Ryan, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right. So I think everyone can hear everyone now.
Outstanding.
Great.
Beauty of technology.
Okay. So you have, you're a playwright.
Yes, that's correct. Been writing plays professionally here in the city for a little over 6 years now, Soraya.
Okay, and Peter Robbins here has helped you with this a little bit.
Yes, Peter. I've known of Peter for probably about 8 years now. After reading some of his earlier papers and reading Left at Eastgate at least 3 times now, front to back.
Glutton for punishment.
Yes, indeed. I love the punishment. But I write plays. I've recently delved into writing screenplays, Soraya. I've always been a writer, and I've finally found an interesting way to mix my passions for the world of ufology with my playwriting.
Nice.
Yes.
And you're also working or starting to work as a ufologist as well, right?
I've always been interested, Soraya. I got interested when I was about 12. Never had that, you know, that quintessential sighting or anything exciting like that, but tripped into the library one day, found a book by Stanton Friedman, and the rest is history, man. I've been reading every book you can think of. I've got two bookshelves here full of every UFO book known to man, probably not known to man, but, you know, sort of put it on the back burner. School took over, girls took over, all that, but I got hooked up with the people at Open Minds, who have a fantastic UFO magazine, and I've been writing freelance UFO journalism for them ever since. That's been going on for about 2 years now, so it's reignited my passion for UFOs, to say the least.
Nice, nice. What made you decide to do a play on Rendlesham?
Very good question. I work very closely, Soraya, with a company here in New York City called Dreamcatcher. Dreamcatcher Entertainment, and they asked me to write a short play having to do with, you know, something in the realm of horror or science fiction or the supernatural, and of course, you know, my mind immediately goes to UFOs. So I decided to do a sort of condensed version of Larry Warren's involvement in the Rendlesham case. And, you know, the playwriting competition that I was in with the piece, it went off without a hitch. Everyone loved it, and I had a gentleman come up to me after, and immediately I hear his British accent, and he says, you know, I lived right near that forest, and right away I thought this guy was going to call me out and think I was trying to make this story, you know, something of my own, and he said, I think this is great what you did. People need to know about this case, and that's really all it took, Soraya. I immediately started working on a full-length play about Rendlesham, and that's when Peter got involved. I wanted to take a certain angle and a certain stance on the case, and having worked with Peter and Larry Warren on a few articles about Rendlesham, I thought, who better than the two men who wrote the probably the best documented book on the incident so far.
Okay. And what kind of stance are you taking on it?
A very human stance, Soraya. I've had a lot of people ask me, how are you going to have this craft flying in on the stage? You know, 30 enlisted personnel in a forest looking up at this thing. And I tried to make it clear to them that what I'm doing is not so much dramatizing Left at Eastgate, but following these two men who it took over a decade to write this book. The research, I can't even imagine how rigorous it was to them, but I decided that I wanted to contact Peter and tell his and Larry's story. So basically it chronicles the decade-long journey that these two men took together, you know, the trials, the tribulations, the good, the bad, and that's what I've decided to do. It's halfway done so far, Soraya, and Peter and I, as I'm sure he can attest to, we've been sitting down at least once a month, having our monthly Rendlesham meetings, mm-hmm. and trying to get this timeline down of the events that happened, not only with the event, but everything that transpired after, within Peter's life and Larry's life, and trying to make it as accurate as humanly possible. There will be liberties taken, you know, it's a full-length play, but I want this thing to be as accurate as it can, down to the nitty-gritty, asking Peter, what were you wearing that day? What mm-hmm. kind of music were you and Larry listening to? What was going on in the world of politics? Everything. And that's sort of where we stand right now.
Yeah, these were the things that made me feel that Ryan was really taking this story in an important direction. This subject has been so neglected in the world of serious stagecraft, where it's been the subject of countless screenplays, of course, from the sublime to the ridiculous. And people that go to the theater overall, you know, they love movies as well. But it's an element that we've never really been able to reach well with this subject. I've been aware of a number of plays trying to address it, all of them somewhat problematic. And Ryan's deciding to take the tack that he has rather than a more sensational one or even attempting to do a play based on the book as much as the story behind the writing of the book appealed to me and to Larry. And I've made a point of not looking at the manuscript at this point. I want it to be developed to, not necessarily finished, but to his satisfaction before I look at it. It's his play and not mine. And I'm glad to be working as a consultant on it.
And where are you planning on running this?
I actually, the theater company that I mentioned earlier, Soraya, Dreamcatcher Entertainment, they're very interested in developing this play with me. I've done several projects with them so far, and to be completely honest, I've approached other theater companies here in the city, and the second they hear that it involves an actual UFO incident, their ears immediately perk, because like Peter said, there's very few stage plays that have ever been written about UFOs, and like Peter said, just a few. It's something that's never been done in the medium of theater, to my knowledge, to this extent, trying to tell a very human story with the background of a famous UFO incident. And again, a famous UFO incident in Britain, whereas not so much here in the United States. And I think that's another thing that I really want to get across here, is not only branching out to a new audience, that being the world of theater, but to an American audience as well. This case was hushed for so long here in the States. And if I can even open one person's eyes to the case and have them read Left at Eastgate and have them be interested in this and start doing their own research, that's really all I can ask for.
Mm-hmm.
I think making it a human story, too, rather than just about the events might help with that.
I couldn't agree more, and a lot of our book, and it's a big book, it's 540 pages, deals with what my co-author went through, not just as a witness, not just as somebody that, along with other key witnesses, was put through a certain amount of mental hell by an aspect of an American intelligence operation to abuse, confuse, frighten the men after the fact. But he was the one who blew the whistle on it, not one of a number of people. He was the person, and he took the heat. And he still does to a degree. And approaching this from the most human area, I mean, it affected my life in ways I would have never imagined and changed me in the course of working on this play. The fact is, I didn't want to work with Larry because I wanted a new friend. In fact, I was not looking to develop a friendship with him. I wanted to objectively chronicle what had happened to this very courageous and angry and obsessed person. And as we got involved, something happened on our first trip over to England that made me part of the story as well. We had a rather overwhelming UFO sighting experience. I thought, good God, you know, who's going to believe us? You know, it just sounds so ludicrous. I mean, it was all audio taped as it was happening because I was always with two tape recorders at the time. And it was on our first night of our first visit out to the base area near where this had occurred. I should say also that those tapes, the original first generation audio tapes, have been voice stress analyzed at our request, and they're not in dispute as far as their authenticity goes. But yeah, the emotional impact, I think people can relate to people more than you can relate to this whole premise if it's intimidating to you.
And I think that's it. If people realize that real people are having these experiences, so often the media puts them down to, oh, it's only crazy people that have these experiences, but that's simply not the case.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. I agree with both of you, and I think that's what I'm trying to do here, is show that this happened to all these men and women on this base, and it ultimately changed their lives forever. And the way they were treated after, Soraya, like Peter said, is just... it's just downright wrong. And if we can even get any sort of justice for them in the eyes of the public, what more can we ask for? And I did want to add one thing. The audio tapes that Peter had mentioned, I have to take a moment to thank him, Soraya. He's given me access to every one of these audio tapes that he's had with Larry and with Colonel Charles Halt and with other members that were involved with the case. And it's a source of material that I never thought I would be privy to in writing this play. And it's helping so much to hear the stress in Peter and Larry's voices as they had this encounter with their first time over in England together. You know, these are not things you can make up. And I only hope it can come across to the audience as well.
You want to tell people a little bit about that encounter?
Yeah. We had arrived in England on whatever date in mid-February we had. It was my second trip to the UK. I was very excited about it and thought, well, this is going to legitimize our efforts. We'll be seen to have actually visited the location together. Little did I know it was my first about 25 trips there, and I'm not exaggerating, between 20 and 25 now. And we found a bed and breakfast about a mile plus from the base Larry had been stationed at. And we got out to that area the day after we arrived in London. We chatted with the family we were staying with, got settled into our room, and at about dusk, Larry was looking out the window at the forest and saying, "There's the forest out there. You want to head out there tonight?" Now, I had been doing the armchair phase of this research for about 7 months. I felt fairly knowledgeable about the case, but kind of jet-lagged and tired. It was February. It wasn't warm out. And my thought was, no, I don't want to go out there tonight. There's aliens and witches and werewolves and God knows what in the woods. And you want me to walk onto a military base? But I couldn't, you know, be unmachoed. And I said, sure. And we headed out at dusk as the sun was going down. And at the time, certainly, and I don't think American bases are like this in the States, but you could, as a civilian, you could just wander around on certain parts of this American base. Obviously, not the secured parts.
Right.
And we ended up at a, like a hallucination. We turned a corner and there was a Burger King. And we went in, realized we had almost no cash with us, and they only took American money. And we had enough money to buy two burgers, a cheeseburger and a regular one. And to cut to the chase, Larry saw a guy across the room. And he said, by the flash on his shoulder, "That was me 8 years ago. I'm going to go chat him up." Within a few minutes, he brings the guy back to the table, and he's a security cop like Larry was, and we start to chat. And Larry says, with no guile, he says, "We're working on a book about some things that happened to me in the service. You know and I know that when you're assigned to a new base, older guys, well, if there's any story or any legend or any myth or anything about the base, you learn it really fast from the guys that have been there. Anything associated with this base?" And this guy, who was probably about 19 or so, got a little bit, you know, not defensive, but he said, "I don't know how you guys feel about the subjects, but there's only one story associated with this base." And he began to tell us the story from what he had heard. This is the first time in over half a year of working on the project that I had heard anybody else authenticate what Larry said. Hmm. And it was very exciting. And when he finished, Larry said, "I want to thank you. I know I put you on a spot. And not only was it true, I was involved as an eyewitness on the third night, and it was more to it than you imagine," and blah, blah, blah. And out we went. And we chatted for a while outside, went our ways, and then we started walking back in the pitch dark to our bed and breakfast. And at 9:30 that night, I saw a light over the forest, an elliptical-shaped light. And I turned on the tape recorder. I says, "Larry, does that look like a tipped ellipse to you?" And I had to listen to the damn thing 40 times because I thought it said a pair of lips. The wind was ripping across the top of the microphone. Mm. Anyway, an hour and a half later, we were still standing there. I was in shock. We had seen no less than 30 different lights under intelligent control, discs, large ones, small ones, a thing appeared at the far end of the field that we were standing in that lit up. It was very, very upsetting for me. And it had happened, and we were stuck with it. And Larry was incredibly apologetic. He said, I told you something was going to happen, but I had no idea. But this is a very loaded area. That condenses it, but that whole transcript is included in the book.
Why did it upset you?
I was overwhelmed.
I was overwhelmed.
I was completely unprepared for this. I had had my childhood sighting with my sister many years before, and I thought I had seen something once when I was on a camping trip. But to see this multiple event happen not 5 or 6 miles from this incredibly overwhelming famous event, and see things that were doing things that nothing I had ever seen in the sky could possibly do. And knowing that I was with arguably as controversial a witness as I could be with, that it was the first night of our first trip. And I actually thought momentarily, and I write about this because it was an important moment for me as an investigative writer. Oh God, if we only have three choices. We can ignore it, which is an amazing lie by omission. I can say, oh yeah, on our first night we saw 30 UFOs, and then go on to the next paragraph. That doesn't work either. Or we could lay it out. And I thought, well, I've got it all on tape. And when I say this is a momentary thought, it was literally that. Maybe we should say it happened on the third night. It just sounds a little better. I said, oh my God, you actually said that. If you do that, you're a liar. And if you do that once, you can't be trusted. You can't trust yourself. You'll do it again. And it was a great moment for me because I realized whatever happens to me in this work, as I had been doing, as they say, when you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. Mm. And that is what I've always tried to do.
Okay. Do you think that this intelligence did this because it knew you were there?
Well, Larry suggested that shortly after, and I was horrified. Like, what are you talking about? This is scary and weird enough. No. It was just a coincidence. But over the years, I really wonder.
Because there are so many reports where these things respond to people.
I do know for a fact that even at that early juncture, and we were hardly a threat to our national security agency or apparatus, but in fact, from that very first visit and before that visit, our communications were monitored irregularly. I know I had my phone checked out that following spring, and there was a tap on my line, to use the old-fashioned term.
Hmm.
I had it done by a guy who worked for Bell Telephone, which they used to call it, and moonlighted doing installations at night. But I learned a decade after this that an exchange of letters between myself and Brenda Butler, who was a local paranormal researcher and co-authored the first book on this, along with the better-known Jenny Randles,
mm-hmm.
and a woman named Dot Street, a book called Sky Crash that came out in 1984. We had exchanged letters with specific information that when I came to England, I would get in touch with her and we'd meet. Somebody read those letters, and somebody contacted her a day after I got to England with Larry, with an American accent, called her on the phone, presented themselves as me, set up an appointment that I obviously didn't keep, and the week flew by, starting as it did, and I completely didn't get in touch with her. And when I got home, I wrote her an apology letter and hoped that we could stay in touch and filled her in on what had happened. And I never heard back from her, and it was 9 years later that she told me in quite a huff why she had never contacted me after that, because I had stood her up. I thought, oh my God. And that was just some schnook who was just starting in this. What we were doing ultimately was a real embarrassment to our National Security Agency, which when our book was first published, as opposed to republished in an expanded edition in 2005, was published in 1997. Most Americans had never heard of the National Security Agency. And interestingly, I should note here that the place where most Americans first heard that term was on a number of very memorable episodes of The X-Files. They did their homework well.
Yes.
Now, of course, they listen to all of us. But at the time, this caused me to become very reclusive and very guarded. And that changed after a while. You can't live in fear.
Right, right. All right. So I'm going to throw this out to both of you just to get your opinions on it. Why do you think certain areas, I mean, they're known as flap areas, and Rendlesham is one of them. Why do you think there's more UFO activity in certain areas than others?
I'll take that first. They're also known as window areas for obvious allegorical reasons. I don't know, but my educated guesses are as follows. There are either actual physical or dimensional portals, which these things come and go from, or we do know for a fact, statistically, and this is not contested, that they, the incidence of documented appearances in and around nuclear facilities, nuclear power plants, areas where nuclear energy is being used, developed, stored, or what have you, attracts their attention, and with good cause, of course. How could they not be interested in this extremely destructive and poisonous kind of stuff? The other thing is that there just may be things about certain areas that are either important to them or have been attractors or bases or of deep interest or involvement to them going back to time immemorial. We don't know.
Ryan?
I have to agree almost with everything Peter said. I think these areas where a lot of UFO incidents do occur, especially with nuclear capabilities, is it's a sign, Soraya. They're monitoring us for either our weaponry or potential danger to ourselves. I think, and especially in Britain, you have such lore and the phenomenon of ley lines, and you know, Rendlesham runs right through one of these supposed ley lines, and just a condensed area of high energy and high strangeness. Like you said earlier, witches, black dogs, aliens, everything happens at Rendlesham. This was only one event, you know, be it extremely important in terms of national and international security. But in general, the paranormal just seems to feed off of these sort of things. And
Paul Devereaux also showed that a lot of UFO encounters happen along fault lines, which seem to connect to ley lines as well.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
this is an area of study I got involved in before I was involved in UFOs. I read a remarkable book that was published in the UK in the 1920s called The Old Straight Track by a gentleman named Alfred Watkins, who was fond of taking long country walks. And it was Watkins who discovered this phenomena of ley lines, which run gun sight straight, in some cases diagonally, straight across Great Britain, and are marked by ancient standing stones, stone circles, burial cairns, natural springs, and in some cases pick up, again, gun sight straight on the other side of the channel in France, which doesn't suggest, it demands our attention, that in ancient, pre-ancient, if there's such a word, times, there was an overview that could have only been established from well above. And what we're looking at here are the rudiments of something wholly other than, you know, ancient tribes that were grunting and, doing very simple things. Yes, and it's very exciting to hike these wonderful trails in Britain. I've made a point of doing a number of them over the years.
Ryan, what would be the thing that has surprised you the most about Rendlesham doing this play?
Oh, great question. I would have to say that, you know, in reading this particular book by Peter and Larry Soraya, you sort of get a sense that this is a historical case, or this already happened, you know. But this is a constantly developing case. All the people involved are still alive, and developments are happening every day. And, you know, as a playwright trying to write a play about it, it's a little frustrating. You know, once you get your story down, something new comes to light, which is both good and exciting. I told Peter, you know, I wanted to end the play at a certain part of the incident, but it just keeps happening. So what do you do from there? I think that would be it, okay. Soraya. It's just surprising how this case is still extremely relevant. There's still movies, books, and plays being written about it. And, yeah, I think it's one of the most important cases there is. And, that's why I got involved. I don't pretend to be a messenger or a poster child for the case. That's not my job. I just want to tell a story.
And I would agree that it's definitely one of the most important cases because of the witnesses, because of yes. the extent of the activity. It's not something that you can say, well, that didn't happen. I mean, there's more than enough evidence that it did happen, and other things have happened there as well to back it up.
Mm-hmm. There's so much evidence to go with it too, Soraya. Just every physical evidence, documentation, it's just, it can't be denied. Something happened, you know, what that is, we may never know, but the journey is more important than the answers.
Yeah, we can't say that visitors from this planet came and landed in Rendlesham, but we can definitely say that something anomalous happened that we can't explain.
Exactly.
I had another question. What was it? Completely out of my head. That is fantastic.
When you get to be your age, these things start to happen.
Happens way too often. You know, sometimes I get so involved with listening to my guests that I don't think of other questions. I'm just listening, and then they stop, and I go, huh.
Tell me more.
Yeah, exactly. Tell me more. I had a question for Ryan about the play, and I've completely forgotten what it was. Okay. You know, one of the things we were talking about earlier when we were talking about Whitley Strieber, a lot of people will dismiss him and say that, well, he just did it for publicity. He just did it to... And you look at that book, you look at how personal communion is and how vulnerable it made him, and there's no sane person on the planet that would have written a book like that for publicity.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree with you. And
agreed.
When Left at Eastgate first came out, a small number, but a number of people let it be known to Larry and I that they felt that our book was too personal. Mm. To a greater degree than not, the overwhelming number of UFO books have been more in the Dragnet school of writing of just the facts, ma'am.
Right.
And I can understand that logic. But for me, the phenomena, the impact of the phenomena, how it changes lives, and sometimes not necessarily for the better, and how, you know, the best steel goes through the hottest fire, as Dickens said, it is a character builder, like it or not. And my co-author, for me, he is a tough, irascible, very, very principled person who doesn't take crap from anyone, who has grown very used to, over the decades, to defending his credibility, his actions, his motivations. And these stories, they give the right grounding, I feel. The impact that it had on me, on my family, my sister, my parents, was as real as the things that happened to Larry. How it challenges relationships, how it can destroy friendships or build extraordinary friendships. It reminds me a little bit like when I studied at the School of Visual Arts. My original intention had been to be a visual artist, a painter. And in certain drawing classes, we would be asked to draw the negative space around objects. And it might be a figure model sitting there, you know, with their hands on their hips. and you would zone in on the shape that was defined by the triangle inside where their hand, you know, was against their body, and you'd start to think in a different polarity. Fleshing out the real people that have had these things happen to them, I think, is as important as exploring and documenting the real scientific evidence that backs them up, physiological changes to the soil, etc. Because one aspect of it does not give you the full story. You need the human story as well as the analytical story.
It also seems that the phenomena, when people have real legitimate strong experiences, it changes them. And that's not something a hallucination will do. And like Kenneth Ring wrote his book comparing the effects of near-death experiences and UFO experiences at the Omega Project, showing that severe change to personality, that these events, that if they were imaginary, they just wouldn't have those effects on people.
You're absolutely right, and that was a very important book for just that reason. For what it's worth, and a slight tangent, one thing that Larry had insisted on to me from the get-go in interviews that I conducted with him was when he was taken into this large, secured underground facility below the base complex. And at first, I must say, the idea of an underground base sounded like Flash Gordon to me. But you'd be surprised how common secured underground facilities are in the world military community. God knows, we have no idea what's going on in our feet, you know, anywhere in the world. But that he had always insisted, as part of the memory of being taken and held against his will for a period of time, and being put through this kind of Disneyland on LSD scenario along with other key witnesses, that he remembered his ears popping as the elevator descended. Those kinds of details fascinate me. And over the months that followed, I spoke to a number of medical and mental health professionals about this and the possibility of an auditory hallucination so real that it fuses a physiological memory into the body's, you know, memory. And they said, no, you know, it happened or it didn't happen. If it was programmed into his mind that he was taken below ground, you can't, you get my point.
And again,
this was from quite a variety of psychologists, psychiatrists, and physicians. So again, off on a tangent here, but the small things are as important as the big things in fleshing it out.
You're on WVBR FM Ithaca, and this is Where Did the Road Go? We're talking with Peter Robbins and Ryan Sprague.
That's correct. Right?
Got it. Okay.
You got him in.
And we are running out of time. I did want to ask you about the there's been a thing coming out of one of them had touched the craft and got a series of ones and zeros.
I better take this.
I think you should, Peter.
A book is being written now by Nick Pope, a colleague of mine, formerly of the Ministry of Defense in the United Kingdom, a well-known UFO personality, writer, researcher, etc. And Nick is working with two key witnesses who were involved on the first night, both law enforcement cops, one of whom watched a light go down in the woods, and the two investigated. And it's a very important part of this story. Jim Peniston, the key player here, and John Burroughs, who is with him, were confronted by a machine of undetermined origin, I don't know, 7 feet across, triangular, tapering upward, appearance of black glass, symbols, hieroglyphics on it, floating about chest height. They went up to it. Jim started to work and make drawings in his book of the figures that he saw. And he's always been on record as saying that when he touched it, he felt kind of a buzz, an electrical buzz. But 30 years after the fact, he made public that when he touched it, a long binary code of quite a few thousand ones and zeros downloaded into his head, and that it was a message from the intelligences behind the event. And after sidestepping on quite a number of occasions giving that information, We are now told that it will be presented fully and finally in the book. And Jim insists that he knows, empirically, without a question, not open to discussion, that the intelligences were time travelers from our future. Now, with respect, I'm looking forward to reading this account, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. he has made it clear that this he will present proof of this. I, along with quite a number of others, seriously question this. And I guess we'll see how it all shakes down in April if the book is published on schedule. I discuss it, so does a great researcher writer named Gary Haseltine, who is a recently retired Yorkshire police detective and approaches ufology from forensic analysis of evidence. Also contributing to this issue of currently available magazine called UFO Truth, I think the best internet available magazine on the subject now, is former Deputy Base Commander Charles I. Halt. And we all express certain concerns and reservations about this whole binary code time travel thesis. Mm-hmm. So it's not a question that we really fully can answer now. But hopefully we'll be able to return to this subject after the book comes out and, you know, discuss it appropriately at that point.
I thought someone had decoded the binary code or something.
Well, it's being, parts have been, and we've been presented with snippets of it.
Ah, okay.
And I believe that they do have somebody doing an extensive analysis with a respectable background in binary code that will all be presented in the book, and we'll see if it, how it weighs.
I think I had heard that they believed it was a longitude-latitude thing that pointed to High Brazil off the coast of England.
Well, one of the things that we're told is that there are five ancient locations, and the numerical aspects of the longitude and latitude go so far beyond coincidence in terms of what they're going to tell us about the event. I'm talking about something I really only have bits and pieces mm-hmm, of, mm-hmm. And that it will present evidence to support the notion that things were presented to Jim in 1980 that we couldn't have known about then. If he's able to make good on that, I will be the first to congratulate him and acknowledge it.
I guess the question is, did he have any record of actually getting this in 1980?
Well, that's one of the things that's being contested. Colonel Halt, deputy base commander, and certainly somebody that knew Jim intimately at the time and in the years since, they've done documentaries together and the like. He said he saw that book, and he didn't see any of this information in it at the time. Mm. It is being contested now, and it's being defended now, and I don't think certainly we're going to hear any statements from Jim or John until after the book is published, and appropriately so. So, yeah, that is one aspect of it, though, Soraya.
Yeah, any thoughts on this, Ryan?
I've really only learned as much as about Peter has about that, Soraya. My big concern with the story that Peniston is bringing forward is when someone claims to have the definitive answer to something, you know, this is time travelers from our future, that's it, that there's no other answer to it, I know what happened, that's where I question the authenticity. To have a clear definitive answer and say that anyone else who has a theory is completely wrong, I do have personal problems with that. This is not to say that what Peniston is bringing forward isn't true, or he doesn't believe it is true.
Yeah.
Or to say he does believe it's true. I apologize. I do have problems with it, but again, just like Peter, I really am looking forward to seeing his proof in the book and eagerly await it. I hope to have this play out around the same time. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
I should also add that my abiding concern from the moment that Jim first announced this at the 30th anniversary conference to mark the event, which I had helped to organize in December of 2010, when he first put this forward to an audience of almost 400 who were not pleased with the fact that he would not discuss it in any detail. The idea,
they were angry.
Yeah, they were very angry. The idea of time travelers is so hypothetical and so associated with the world of science fiction. There's so much extraordinary real evidence to back up this case. My concern is that when this book comes out, they'll certainly be doing, you know, interviews and that kind of thing, that the media will have an absolute ball focusing in on time travelers from our future, which is as big a wink-wink, nod-nod kind of catchphrase as one could imagine, and lose sight of the importance and the evidence backing up this seminal incident. Mm-hmm. I don't think Jim and John have come to feel, I can only guess what, about this aspect of the story, but my feeling is that maybe Jim has had this put in his head to come forward at a later date to demean the case, which I think is a lot less far out a premise than that he has been chosen from amongst humanity to reveal this extraordinarily important message to the rest of us mortals. We'll see.
Which leads to my other question. Do the witnesses who have come forward, do they agree on a lot of this stuff, or are there a lot of disagreements?
Well, there is some agreement and some disagreement. The best way I can explain it is if you, me, and Ryan, and six other people, you know, at some point in the future, standing in Midtown Ithaca chatting, and we happen to be looking into the road at a time when two cars collide. This happened to me once in my life. I actually was looking at a street as there was a car crash right there. And when we were interviewed as witnesses, as we should be, by law enforcement, we all saw the same thing, but we would all give differing accounts, either in minor ways or major ways. It's part of the nature of physiological shock and the way that our minds process information, the angle we're seeing things at. Also, remember, we're talking about a series of events that occurred on three consecutive nights. With different people involved, some people involved in more than one event, wedges driven between certain witnesses, unfortunately, by higher up people in the establishment for reasons that we don't have to do too much wild guessing on.
Has the military ever commented on it?
Well, they've had to, because when my co-author Larry Warren did come forward in 82, and gave an account naming every name that he was aware of at the time, and not with the permission of the individuals involved, and hence a certain amount of the blowback to Larry for outing all of these people. The information that he gave Larry Fawcett, who is a fairly well-known UFO investigator at the time, and at least as important, a police lieutenant in Coventry, Connecticut, and certainly knew how to investigate. The information that Larry Warren gave Larry Fawcett, and no other information, was put into the form of a Freedom of Information Act action in early 83, which resulted in the release of Colonel Halt's one-page memo on the event written 3 years after the 3 weeks after the fact, highly redacted, compressed, minimized, but on Air Force letterhead, signed by the deputy base commander. And as such, we had to at least admit that was real, but they have not commented beyond that much. And the Ministry of Defense, which I think really was not in the loop to a great degree, erred tremendously by saying that whatever had happened there was of no defense significance. How dare they say something like that when they don't even know what they're talking about? And when they're, after the fact, we know that it was a nuclear base.
Yeah, yeah, because it wasn't known to be a nuclear base at the time. They were denying it, weren't they?
Well, they were, exactly. And that's another thing.
Treaty.
That's another thing that Larry caught holy hell on and lost his passport on for a while, for quote unquote speaking out on sensitive defense issues in a public forum on foreign soil in a talk he gave in '93 in Nottingham. He was the one who revealed that there was a tremendous treaty violation going on at the time. And that is another aspect of this whole story. We had a lot of nuclear ordnance in Suffolk at the time. And by virtue of our treaty, we should not have had any.
Yeah, well, that sounds about right.
Shocking, I know.
I mean, it begs the question as to why they stayed so silent for so long and wanted everything hushed up, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, where can people find more information on the play?
Oh, they can find more information, Soraya, to follow the progression through Facebook, you know, the glory of social media. It's just facebook.com/Rendlesham Play. I constantly am updating people on Peter and I's meetings and what we talked about. Mm-hmm. Again, I hope to have a complete script done by the tail end of 2013. And yeah, that's about it right now, Soraya. Got almost 500 followers on the page now, and really growing every day. And so happy and honored to be working directly with Peter and Larry. I've talked to Larry a few times via email and through Facebook, and he's really excited. He just wants his story told the way it actually happened, and that's the way the book went, and that's the way the play's going to go.
Nice. All right. Anything else people should know about the play?
It's going to be exciting. I didn't mention, like Peter had mentioned earlier, his late sister was an extremely big part of this entire thing in supporting Larry and Peter on their endeavors. And Peter has given me the blessing to bring her back to life the way I see fit in the play. And
yeah.
I really think this is going to be a breakout role for some young broad here in the city and abroad. And you know, with what all she did for the punk movement and coming forward with her abduction story. Yeah, very excited to get word out about that. And it's going to be a heck of a play. I can't wait to invite all my UFO friends to see it, all my theater friends to see it, and really get people talking.
And Ryan, I hope I'm not giving away something important here, but George Clooney has agreed to play me, and Brad Pitt will be playing Larry.
Perfect. You know, I know you were waiting for that photo. I'm glad it happened.
We're going mostly for the photographic resemblances, really. But
oh, of course. But yeah, I'm very excited. Larry is a very interesting guy. Very outspoken. He's been a ball to write. Peter being the main protagonist of the play is extremely refreshing to write, Soraya. And Helen, you know, Bud Hopkins is going to be in there, a few other people involved. You know, it's the all-stars of ufology all in one place.
Nice.
If that's not a pitch, I don't know what is.
And if people want to check out your other work, your website is what?
That would just be RyanDSprague.com, D as in dog. Yeah, they can keep up to date with my movies, my plays, and my UFO work. I have an article coming out for Open Minds. They can just be found at openminds.tv. Did a piece for UFO Truth magazine that Peter just mentioned. Mm-hmm. All Gary Heseltine, Peter and I all have articles in that issue, so people mm-hmm. should definitely check that out as well. Gosh. Fantastic online magazine.
Yeah.
And your last name is spelled Sprague.
That's correct. Prague with an S.
And Peter, you still don't have a web presence yet as far as a website?
Hopefully by the beginning of January, and I'll keep you posted on that. Should
right.
be up and running
okay.
again. Yeah.
Excellent.
Otherwise, right. Peter Robbins, Facebook, but I'm the one in Ithaca.
Yes, there are some other famous Peter Robbins out there.
Oh, the nerd.
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us tonight. And appropriate links will be posted in the show archive with this show. So people will be able to find that stuff easily there. And The Last Exit for the Lost is up next. Any last words?
Speak to you soon, Ryan.
You as well, Peter. Thanks so much, Soraya.
Here's Psyche Corporation taking us out.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Into the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atria. Chambers numbered 1597. And counting. And counting.